My name's Bob. James Bond.
Hello, this is Jerry Pippin. All of us have seen the James Bond movies. Many of us have read the books by Ian Fleming. It was all supposed to be fiction. A secret agent with a license to kill. Tonight on this program, you might wish to rethink that idea that this is fiction. We have with us on the line from Florida, H.B. Albarelli. He's a well-connected person. He even worked in the Carter White House at one time. And I can tell you this much, he's one heck of a good investigative reporter. He has a big, thick book out, A True Crime Thriller, A Terrible Mistake, The Murder of Frank Olson, and the CIA's Secret Cold War Experiments. But what we're going to talk about with Hank tonight is not ancient history. This stuff is still going on long after the Cold War has ended. And actually, perhaps it's going on even more often and with more intensity than ever before. Hank, I hope you don't mind me calling you Hank. I understand that's what they call you. Welcome to the show.
Sure, Jerry. Thank you very much for having me on today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, the book is, I guess the comment I hear the most lately is the book is a big book. It's about close to 900 pages long, but it was really necessary for the book to run that long. But it's the story, essentially the story of Frank Olson's death. It has a fair amount about his life prior to his going to work for the CIA. But the story focuses primarily on the events, which are quite convoluted, that circle his final days on Earth and his death, and delve quite a bit into the CIA's activities in terms of drug experiments and mind control experiments, as well as the U.S. Army experiments, which have never really been covered adequately in a book before.
One thing about a big, thick book, Hank, is it takes a long time to read it all the way through. But they probably never think about it when you're reading it, but it takes a long time to write something that long. I bet you spent some time with this. I bet it took some time.
It did. It took over 10 years, probably closer to 11 years of researching alone, and then a couple years writing. And for the most part, time went by pretty quickly. It was a fascinating task of researching and covered a lot of ground, both in the United States and in Europe, but generally was rewarding because the research turned up so many fascinating stories related to Olson and the CIA and the Army.
Well, Hank, you're like me. You got a little age on you, but I don't think you're that old. Did you know Olson?
No, I didn't. Olson died in 53. In 1953, I was 7 or 8 years old.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to get that clear. Speaking of getting things clear, you know, we think of all these things that are in this book about being current everyday activities in the 21st century. Of the CIA, the KGB, and people like that. But, I mean, this is back in the 50s, and all this stuff is going on back then, too. That was pretty surprising.
That was one of the things that really startled me. I guess, in a lot of ways, I'm an investigative reporter, but that certainly doesn't mean I'm aware of everything that's going on, even in those subjects where I'm well-versed. And like a lot of people in the United States, I was under the impression that torture in our country's shameful participation in torture really started as a result of 9/11, and although it's a complex story and some people see it as a justified activity, again, it was a recent activity, torture, I mean. And what I found in my research, that torture wasn't a recent activity at all, that its history extends back to the late 40s and the early 1950s, and really picked up and accelerated from those years forward, and has been nonstop. And that was primarily with, to begin with Project Artichoke, which was a CIA programs, top secret program, that involved a lot of other intelligence agencies and governmental agencies. But that was a high-level, top secret program, which basically fell into the category of enhanced interrogation. But the parameters of the program were just wide-reaching, worldwide, and covered far more than just simple interrogation. It went into areas like hypnotism, lobotomy, shock therapy, you name it. They covered it.
Well, it looks like we've had torture kings and queens with the U.S. government for some time. I mean, for decades. Artichoke. Interesting name. Tell our audience a little bit about what we're talking about, Hank.
Well, Artichoke was a project started in the early 50s. It stemmed from one of the first so-called mind control projects that the CIA undertook, and that was briefly called Project Bluebird. And it was run by the CIA's Office of Security. And the purpose of that initial program, Project Bluebird, wasn't so much directed towards mind control, but was directed towards security and the CIA's concerns about having perhaps too much knowledge and then how that knowledge was handled after they left the agency or retired. And what the agency actually wanted to do, as far-fetched as it seems, was create the means to erase the memories of CIA agents after they would retire or leave the agency, and that wasn't too practical. So Project Bluebird evolved into Project Artichoke, and Artichoke, again, was far-reaching and mainly focused on interrogation and how to, with double agents and triple agents and agents of enemy governments, primarily agents from communist governments, and how to get into their heads and how to get whatever information they had to get them to reveal the information they had. But gradually the program evolved, and towards the end, about 15 years down the road, it was well into the areas of assassination. And it had several dimensions, not only interrogation, but assassination and touching somewhat on biological and chemical warfare.
In the Vietnam era, I remember assassinations going on, of heads of state. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, the big story, where I got the most information research-wise, the assassination was directed at Fidel Castro. There were actually 8 or 9 attempts to kill him, very serious attempts that all failed. But yes, it was directed at other leaders of foreign countries, Patrice Lumumba in the Belgium Congo, and that involved a number of CIA employees and contractors. It actually involved one of the CIA contractors that killed Frank Olson in 1953. And probably domestically. The real problem with researching assassination in the CIA is, of course, that there's very little that's left in writing, and there's very little that initially goes into writing. And I think when Richard Helms once testified before Congress, he made a point of telling the committee he was appearing before that, of course, they would never reduce anything concerning assassination to writing, and they had made that mistake a few times, but that it just wasn't a practice to put things in writing. But nonetheless, a lot came out, even after the attempts against Fidel Castro, and the government, the CIA, made a lot of overtures, very successful overtures, to members of organized crime and various mafia families in the 50s and 60s, and recruited people like Johnny Roselli, who was a pretty mobbed-up character, Santos Trafficante, who was in Tampa, Florida, and who headed up that wing of the heroin trafficking activities for the mob and the mafia. people in Chicago, people in Detroit, and there was a period of time, it was pretty embarrassing really to look at it, I think, on the part of the CIA, but there was kind of a revolving door policy for mobbed up characters in and out of the CIA who were constantly meeting with high-level CIA people like William Harvey and Colby and Helms, and I think the agency was under the impression for a long time that it could learn a lot from the mafia in terms of the so-called art of killing, but it doesn't seem like they did. It's really hard to tell. Of course, we don't have any idea how many people they actually killed. We know about a few high-profile people, but a lot of low-profile people probably went to their deaths at the hands of the CIA that we know absolutely nothing whatsoever about.
Kind of let that go by, Hank, but the CIA evidently had contract labor that hired murderers to kill more than one person, and not necessarily just in the U.S., but wherever. I've often wondered who made those decisions, who decided who was going to get it, who was going to get hacked.
Well, that's an interesting question. Generally, from what I can tell, the decision, the actual order came from the top of the agency, and that was Alan Dulles.
The CIA director.
The CIA director or assistant director, who was Cabell for a long time and down. There is a lot of evidence that on a few occasions the presidents of the United States were consulted. There's evidence that Eisenhower was consulted at least once about attempts against some world leaders, and that JFK and RFK were privy to at least one or two attempts against Fidel Castro. It's been reported that RFK, that Bobby Kennedy, wasn't too pleased when he learned about the initial attempts against Castro, but I guess after he calmed down, he realized that maybe there was some wisdom in terms of, I don't know what wisdom, in terms of attempts to kill Castro, and there was at least one reported conversation, meeting between the CIA and Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, where he seemed to be complicit in one of the attempts against Castro.
This is really worse than a fiction thriller. Here we have the President of the United States, the Attorney General, and on attempted assassinations, and then they both get assassinated, probably by the same people.
Well, yes. and I spent a fair amount of time looking into that, only because, well, for a number of reasons, but the primary reason in terms of researching the Olson book was that I found that one of the characters who actually killed Frank Olson, he was a Frenchman who went under the name Jean-Pierre Lafitte, after he killed Olson in 1963, popped up in New Orleans at the same time that Lee Harvey Oswald was in New Orleans, and for a short period of time Lafitte actually worked with Oswald at the Riley Coffee Company. This is prior to Kennedy's assassination. And that coffee company was long rumored to be a CIA front, and I think the evidence of that is pretty overwhelming. And then after Lafitte left his employment with the coffee company, he went on to work for the International Trade Mart, and his supervisor was Clay Shaw, who of course was implicated in the Kennedy assassination by Jim Garrison unsuccessfully in the 70s, but I think all those facts alone were far more than coincidental. Lafitte actually ended up leaving New Orleans after he was arrested by the FBI while in the employment of Clay Shaw. And the reason I knew he was in New Orleans to begin with was because of CIA files, and then fortunately an article in Time magazine in 1963 that recorded his arrest. But then when I went through FBI files, I found that 2 days after he was arrested, for some odd reason that's not recorded anywhere, he was released. And he basically disappeared for a few years and didn't turn up again until he was in the Belgium Congo.
And what was he doing in the Belgian Congo?
Well, I suspect he was there for the assassination of Patrice Lumumba.
Yeah, that's the reason I asked that.
Yeah, but we don't know for sure. He tipped his hand on that because he actually sent a postcard from the Belgium Congo to a reporter, a well-known reporter who worked for Saturday Evening Post and True Magazine at the same time, and the reporter, fortunately enough, kept the postcard, and it was dated the same year and month that Lumumba was murdered in the Congo. And of course, the identity of QJ Wynn, who's always been identified by the code name QJ Wynn as the person who was in the Congo to kill Lumumba, probably applied to Lafitte. But we don't know that for sure.
You know, I never did really understand why we wanted to kill Patrice Lumumba, but I guess that directive came from the president.
There was a meeting. I know there's minutes from a meeting that was held between Dulles and I guess it was Eisenhower at that point in time. I don't think Kennedy had taken over yet. There were certainly some words that were exchanged that Lumumba should die. There was something said to the effect, I don't have it right in front of me, but that the head should be taken off the snake. So that sounded pretty direct. I think the order, according to former CIA people who have actually written books about it subsequently, that the order came from Dulles, there's no doubt whatsoever.
As certain as I am that Alan Dulles was a first-class rat, it's hard to believe he acted alone, however.
It is hard to believe. Of course, I never met Alan Dulles as a man, but I spent a lot of time studying him as a person and reading everything, virtually everything I could get my hands on about him. And there was no doubt that he was a pretty arrogant person. He'd come off from Wall Street and where he'd worked with a very powerful law firm. And I think in a lot of ways, Dulles's personality and method of operation reflected the same with a lot of people that were with the CIA in the 50s, whereby they really considered themselves, and they used this term once in a while, Knights Templar, in the cause to promote freedom and democracy, and they were more than willing to roll over or exterminate anybody that got in their way. That was just the thinking at that point in time.
I think it's pretty clear they all thought they were above the law.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely.
I guess they were.
Well, they were, because that's the proof of the pudding. They got away with all this stuff, and the remarkable thing is, and it's kind of embarrassing as an American to look at this, even when people suspected these assassination activities for a long time, but even when they were finally revealed in my book and in other books, people just kind of roll along with it and don't seem to have any concern whatsoever that their government was, for no provocative reason that I could see, assassinating foreign leaders. Certainly Patrice Lumumba didn't present any threat that I could perceive to the United States.
Now, what did Lumumba do to get on that list? The crap.
Well, he was a communist / socialist / non-cooperative person, and we see that happen with a lot of people today. We see that in Latin America and South America. If people, you know, if leaders of smaller countries don't agree to walk or march in lockstep with the United States, they end up on a list where they're not strongly favored. The activities of the 50s are even sort of synonymous with what's going on today in terms of Obama's order a couple days ago giving the CIA and the Army the green light to actually assassinate an American citizen overseas who's strongly suspected of being involved in the murders of other American citizens. But we really don't have solid evidence of that. And And it's kind of baffling that that an American president would place himself above the law and the Constitution and assume that he has the authority to order anyone's murder. Capture, jailing, prison, interrogation, that's fine. We should capture all these people, and they should be subject to the rule of law, the same as anyone in this country. But just to say, yeah, fine, go ahead and kill them. I don't know. That crosses a line that leads to a very slippery slope. And
it seems like we've been in that slippery slope for some time now.
We have for it all started. It all really accelerated during the Bush administration, where there seemed to be no regard whatsoever for human rights.
And many people are shocked, or surprised at least, that Obama seems to be following in Bush's footsteps. I wonder what happens when you become president.
I agree, and it's very disappointing. Obama made some. A lot of people got excited about Obama, excited about Obama, and it led to a lot of votes in his favor in the past election. But I think, he's disappointed a lot of people when he turned around and put on some of the same clothing that the Bush and Cheney administration wore. I think he's seriously disappointed a lot of
people. Yeah, I think it's tragic. People were hoping for a change. They didn't get it. What do you think happens? You've been an investigative reporter. You were in the White House. What happens to these guys when they become president? They seem to change. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I have, Jerry. And I really, I worked in the White House in the Carter administration, and I can say, and I'm fully cognizant of the fact that a lot of people regard Jimmy Carter as a failed president. I don't agree with that.
I don't either.
I think if Carter had any faults or failings, it was that, and this is hard to say, that maybe he had a little too much respect for human rights, although I don't believe you can have too much respect.
I understand what you're saying.
And he was a very good man, but it seems like everyone that's followed in Carter's footsteps has to adopt this macho machismo kind of cowboy attitude, where they can they can shoot or slay anybody that gets in their way. I can't explain it. I think
Hank, what did you do in the White House? What was your job?
I had nothing to do with policy. I worked in the Presidential Personnel Office, which is primarily the plum office.
Were you able to pick up an ambiance of what was going on around there?
Well, I was privy to a fair amount, a lot I shouldn't talk about, but I can absolutely say I never took part or overheard or witnessed anything that I was ashamed of. And I was quite proud of my days working there, and I was quite proud of the president at that time. And I was very disappointed when all of the stuff happened in Iran, and Carter was going out of his way simply to try to preserve the life of those hostages, and yet things got turned around, and he got portrayed as a loser and a wimp, and only because he cared a little too much about people. And again, that goes to that cowboy attitude. It's equally disappointing to see Obama picking up on that, because Obama didn't strike me as that kind of person to begin with.
Take a good look at Obama objectively, and there's not much difference between him and Bush.
I think a lot of presidents, maybe in fairness, I don't think this was the case with Carter, but I suspect it is the case with Obama, and probably was the case with Clinton, is they fear the CIA, and I think to a certain extent they fear the Army. Because they know both institutions operate independently of the presidency, despite the fact that he's supposed to be the commander-in-chief. And there's pretty good evidence that, they've taken down people who've gotten in their way, such as JFK, RFK, Martin Luther King. A lot of people, William Pepper has written a couple books in recent years claiming that it was actually the U.S. Army that killed King, and nobody seems to want to pay attention to that, but but the evidence there is pretty strong.
Yeah,
too.
Yes, it is.
I think maybe U.S. presidents just go along so they can get. You don't know. As horrible and scary as that sounds, maybe once you're in office, you realize that there are forces you can't overcome or get around. And I think that was the case. I think that overtly was demonstrated during the Dulles years of the CIA, even though they maybe had a chummy relationship with the CIA, with the White House, rather. But they more or less had carte blanche, and a good example is what my book covers with the just horrendous drug experiments that were conducted for nearly 25 or 30 years, involving countless American citizens and service people. Yet, even when that was revealed in the mid-70s, in 75, 76, and 77, nobody batted an eyelash. Nobody seemed concerned about it. It was like, okay, mea culpa, let's move on.
Uh-huh. You know, I've done a fair amount of investigative reporting over the years, Hank, and it's one of the things that really is disappointing. You put your life on the line almost. I guess you could actually say you do sometimes. And you come out with a story, and basically you last a couple of days, and everybody goes, oh, hum, and back to work. You know what I mean?
It is. It's very discouraging, especially today. I think keying in on is that nobody does investigative reporting anymore.
No, they
and
don't.
Even the big, you know, the Washington Post, the New York Times, it's so rare to see an investigative piece, and maybe you'll see something, you know, occasionally by Bob Woodward, but that's not investigative reporting. I mean, he walks over to the White House and gets to sit in
as a member
of the National Security
Council. Right, he gets what they want him to know.
Yeah, and then we're expected to believe he had to work for that, and that what he's telling us is some great revelation. Whereas, you know, if we, in retrospect, we can look back the last 6 to 8 years and see that a lot of what reporters like Woodward and other so-called investigative reporters, Judy Miller and others, what they fed us was basically the party line, and was, you know, served as sort of a pep rally for the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, and complemented everything that Cheney and Powell were telling us at the UN. And even though people now, with little effort, can just look at a few old newspapers and realize that we were lied to, that we were blatantly lied to, hoodwinked into war, and that, you know, hundreds of American troops and men and women died because of it, nobody seems to be concerned about that stuff any longer. Nobody seems to have any regard for it. Nobody feels any shame or anger or outrage. And I know it's hard. I know a lot of people, it's hard probably for you and for me. You can become outraged today, but where do you direct it? If you write a letter to Congress and say that you're disappointed in your country and what elected officials and the president's doing, chances, 9 out of 10, the chances are you're going to get a letter back saying, thank you very much for your support.
Yeah.
And you're going to realize instantly that nobody read the letter you put a lot of thought and effort into. I've had that actually happen to me numerous times. I've come to the point where I don't write those letters anymore because I know that nobody reads them, especially the person they're addressed to. And it's really insulting to get that kind of reply. So where... You know, if you can't even go to the officials that you elected to represent you in Congress, where else is there to go? You write a letter to a newspaper, they're not going to publish it. So I think a lot of people are extremely frustrated today, and they don't know what to do, and I understand that. But I think the damaging part of that is that you just have a lot of pent-up anger and frustration and confusion in the country. And I think a lot of that, you're starting to see the manifestations of that in the last 3 or 4 months, the rise of the militia groups again, all these threats to, I just heard on the radio this morning about 2 or 3 threats to murder Congress people. I don't think all that's coincidental or just by chance. I think it's all a manifestation of the pent-up anger, confusion, and outrage on the part of Americans, and they don't know what to do any longer. And that sort of, that was the same psychology that went into the racial riots in the 60s, that you just had, you had an explosive psychology at play, and I think you have the same psychology at play now that cuts across all racial and ethnic groups and all religions. And people are very angry at their government, and it's not a good situation.
Well, we got a situation here. Our first half hour is up. We have half hour number 2 scheduled next. Millions have witnessed on movie screens around the world, beginning in the 1950s and right on through 2010. Landing of flying saucers. Many of these movies were made in New Mexico. And this year, from July 1 through July 4, during the 63rd anniversary of the Roswell 1947 UFO crash, these motion pictures will once again be part of the gigantic celebration and fun over that weekend in Roswell. Make your plans now. Rooms will soon be at a premium. Thousands from around the world are coming to Roswell, the Mecca for UFO lore. It's an event of a lifetime. Roswell, 2010. Roswell, July 4th weekend. Be there. Welcome back to our show. We have given the show a name, Murder Incorporated, a.k.a. CIA, KGB, MI5. Our guest is H.B. Abarelli, Jr., and he has written a true life thriller, really, and a shocker. It's called A Terrible Mistake, The Murder of Frank Olson and the CIA's Secret Cold War Experiment. If you listen to the first half hour, the conversation has gone beyond this incident, which happened back in the early 50s. But we need to get back to that story, which is pretty incredible in itself. First of all, Hank, at the break, we were discussing the political landscape and the frustration, almost hopelessness, of the people in general.
Well, they are, and it's all like, it's almost like them against us now, and that's a dimension that's even more depressing and disappointing, is that, you know, at one time, when I was a kid, at one time, you know, it was government, and yeah, you know, bureaucracy was cumbersome, but government was there to help us.
Mm-hmm.
The prevailing attitude now across the country is that it's us against government, that government's a hindrance, an obstacle, something that needs to be overcome to make life better, or to make your business more profitable, or to get by. And nobody views government as a useful tool or mechanism to help you get ahead. It's certainly a major obstacle now to small businesses. I know more small businesses across the country that are threatened by government. Just, you know, like some of these horrible regulations that have been put in place, both in terms of just business and education, and these people are just clinging by their fingernails to the few business that they have remaining, and they can't turn to government because it's government that's basically driving them out of business. And then people that are unemployed, it's because of NAFTA and GATT, and you know, a lot of these plant closings have nothing to do with the economy. It's simply that they close up and move overseas. They go to China, they go to Mexico, they go Latin America, and they just chase the cheap wages. So for anybody not to understand and appreciate why people are getting frustrated and angry, it's baffling if you don't. People have every right to become that way. You got over a million people unemployed in Ohio alone who may never go back to work again. What do you tell those million people?
Mm-hmm. We're going to get back to the subject here in a moment. This is not a bash Obama program, but as long as we're talking about the subject, I think when he ran on change and then didn't change things, the damage was very, very severe, especially to younger voters, voters who thought voting might make a difference. In many ways, I'm afraid he's done more damage than Bush Cheney.
Well, he did. He when he ran, and we all got sort of fooled into it. He used those two magic words that Americans love. He used hope, and he used change, mm-hmm. and he was going to bring put both of those things back into the body politic, and he was going to put both of those things back into everybody's working day and days of leisure with their family. He's going to bring hope and change to the country. And that I can see, there's no hope and change. The health care debate turned into a big joke and charade on people. They sold out to the insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all more slaves of the insurance companies than we ever have been. And they did that just so that they could say they had a victory. The only people celebrating that victory were maybe a handful of people in the White House and the Republicans who knew that they really beat them at their own game.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say all this stuff because, you know, I put myself in the camp still of people that want to see Obama succeed. I really expected him to go down as one of the best presidents this country ever had, only because he had the intellect to deliver on that. But
yeah, something happened.
Yeah, something terrible happened.
I mean, even with your book, it proves that conspiracies really do exist, and so it appears that some of these people who say, "Yeah, he got to the White House and somebody walked in the Oval Office and straightened him out."
Well, I think there's a good chance of that, or the message is conveyed subtly somehow.
Yeah, I think it's more likely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just if you look at Obama's appointment to head up the CIA. Now, I know the CIA has been undercut a lot by the whole Homeland Security apparatus and some of the other new intelligence levels, but Leon Panetta, I guess, was, you know, a fine guy and has done some good things in the past, but I don't know what qualified him to walk in and lead the CIA.
Yeah, that was kind of an amazing.
No, it was a really odd choice, and I suspect it was just to put somebody in there that could play the part, but not rock the boat at all. And I think if the one thing I learned in writing my book. And that I could have written a book maybe two or three times as large as that book just by going off on into areas like drug trafficking and control of smaller countries and interference in other economies, is that the CIA is a massive, massive organization. And so massive now that you can't even find anybody in Congress that can tell you what their budget is. And if you ask certain people in Congress that should know, I've had people in Congress actually tell me, I don't want to know. That's really not information.
And why do you think they say that?
I think they're absolutely afraid of the CIA.
Yeah.
I think they absolutely are. And they don't even know how many employees the agency has. At last count, believe it or not, the agency had over 100,000 employees worldwide. And nationwide, I've learned when I was researching the book that the CIA has something like 4,000 domestic corporations, small businesses in the United States that they operate. And these are everything from flower shops to bookstores to dry cleaners. And all it's said in the way of justification is that those things are needed to be in place in order to do their job. But these are domestic businesses, meaning businesses in the United States, and on top of that, the CIA has employees in every major city in the country. There's a CIA office not far from where I sit right now in Tampa. There's a CIA office in New York, Chicago, everywhere you go.
And what are they?
And yet,
do?
By charter, they're not supposed to operate in the United States.
And Hank, what do you think they are doing in those offices? I mean, what are they doing?
Nobody would tell you.
Knows.
Some of them are very small offices.
Yeah,
I tried
understand.
To visit a couple, and you know, I couldn't get beyond the front desk. But it appeared as if maybe there were no more than five or six people working there. But maybe, you know, maybe somebody could say, well, there's a CIA office in Tampa because, you know, the command is in Tampa for the war, the command center and all the technology, and maybe it has something to do with defending that. But on top of the CIA, there's a huge apparatus, there's a huge organization of Army intelligence that doesn't even talk to the CIA people. So it doesn't seem like you'd need all those layers. When Frank Olson was killed in 1953, one of the startling things I learned is that immediately after his death, after his murder, that we subsequently learned it was his murder, CIA agents were dispatched to both the hotel and the medical examiner's office in New York City and to the New York City Police Department. And I assumed before I looked at the files that I was going to see that they either got on a quick airplane out of Washington, D.C. and traveled to New York or got on a fast train. This is 1953. But what I learned was that they were there within minutes, which means they came out of the New York office. The New York office at that point in time was in Rockefeller Center, and they had basically inherited the same offices that the OSS had occupied during the Second World War. But they flooded New York City with agents to cover up Olson's murder, and remarkably enough, within an hour, had successfully done that and had actually gone to all the newspapers. And the next day when the sun came up, Olson died at 2:30 in the morning. At 6 o'clock the next morning when all the newspapers came out in New York City and Washington, D.C., there was just a little notice that said a guy called Frank Olson jumped out of a window in a hotel in New York because he was depressed and died. But what the article didn't say was that he didn't just jump out of a window. He jumped through a window that was closed and had a canvas shade and a curtain drawn in front of it. It was 2:30 in the morning. There wasn't a light on in the room, but there was a CIA man in the room who was there when the police came, the uniformed police came. And the first question they asked the CIA fella, his name was Robert Lashbrook, and he didn't identify himself as CIA to the police, but they said, why, are you aware of the fact that your friend is dead on the sidewalk outside? And Lashbrook said, yes, I am. And the other cop said, well, why didn't you go out and check on him once you realized he'd gone through the window? And Lashbrook's reply, according to the police report, this isn't a CIA report, was, well, I knew he was dead, so I figured I'd just sit here and wait for you to come. I interviewed another person who was present when that question was asked was the night manager of the Statler Hotel in 1953, and he had actually gone up to the room and let the police in. And so he was standing behind the two uniformed police officers when Lashbrook said that. And when I interviewed him many, many years later down here in Florida at his home, he still got angry about it, and he almost exploded, and he jumped up from the couch, and he says, well, what kind of animal reacts like that? Your friend's dead on the sidewalk, and you're just sitting in the room waiting for the police to come? And his name was Armand Pastore, and all I could say was, Armand, I don't know. You know, I said, any normal person would have been, you know, running down the stairs or going down in the elevator and trying to find out what was happening. Olson actually died in Armand Pastore's arms. He actually lived after falling 170 feet, and Pastore ran outside when he realized somebody had gone out the hotel window, and Olson was trying desperately to say something to him, but was so broken up inside that he was unable to, and he just died Pastore was trying to hear what he was saying.
You figure this Lashbrook fellow did it?
No, Lashbrook didn't do it. What the book reveals, and I don't want to ruin a story.
Yeah, I understand.
But that there were actually two people in the adjoining room. There was an adjoining room to the room Lashbrook and Olson was in. They were in room 1018A. And in the B room, which connected to their room, were two contract employees for the CIA who came in the middle of the night to take Olson out of the hotel. Olson, a couple nights earlier, had gotten wind of the fact, or not gotten wind, but realized that his number was up and he had been indiscreet his past few months of employment with the CIA and the Army, and he talked out of school about a number of experiments, thinking that he was going to leave work with the Army and the CIA and retrain himself as a dentist. But the CIA and Army were extremely concerned about his indiscretions, and they took him to New York for basically a damage assessment. And when he realized that, when he really realized what was going on, two nights before his death, he actually tried to escape the hotel, but he was apprehended by these same two characters and brought back. And then on the night that he died, the same thing happened. He thought, you know, he could leave at 2:30 in the morning. Two nights earlier, he had actually thrown, at least the CIA report says he had actually thrown his wallet and credentials away. And I can't imagine why. But I think they took them away so he wouldn't be able to travel. But when he tried to leave the room again, there was a struggle, and he was thrown through the window, through the closed window. And certainly nobody would plan a death that way.
But I bet you no one was prosecuted.
No one was ever prosecuted, and everyone believed from 1953 until 1975 that he had simply become depressed and killed himself. And then in 1975, it was revealed through the Rockefeller Commission that Frank Olson had been given LSD by the CIA 9 days before his death. And then the story that was cooked up then was, well, that's what made him depressed, because he'd been given LSD. But the amount of LSD that he had been given was absurdly small, and again, it was for interrogation purposes to do damage assessment on him. And when in 1975, when a few savvy investigative reporters started asking more questions about the story that the White House put out, this was Gerald Ford's White House then, again, the White House went into overdrive and did yet another cover-up of the Olson death. And the two people, remarkably enough, that led that cover-up effort were Donald Rumsfeld, who was Gerald Ford's chief of staff, and Rumsfeld's special assistant, who happened to be Dick Cheney.
Wow.
And there was a very elaborate cover-up unrolled in 1975, and the Olson death yet again went down as basically a suicide because of depression.
Why was Olson so important to some people in high places in Washington?
Well, he wasn't. But what was really important, it took me 6-7 years to find this out, what Olson had committed a mortal sin with the agency and the Army. He thought he was going to leave, and as a man, he was fairly arrogant and outspoken to begin with. He was really in the wrong environment from the get-go. He wasn't a person that cared much for authority or authority figures. He was very egotistical and as said, arrogant and outspoken. And when he decided he was going to leave employment with the Army and the CIA, he thought, you know, I guess he thought he was being cute or whatever, and he talked to a number of people about things he shouldn't have talked to, and all of these people reported him back to various Army and agency authorities. And one of the things that Olson talked about that upset them the most and caused them to do this damage assessment on him was an experiment that he had participated in August of 1951 in a small town in France called Pont-Saint-Esprit. And what basically Olsen's division, which was part of Fort Detrick's Special Operations Division then, which was an ultra-secret group, what they did in France was to conduct, at the direction of the Army, a top-secret experiment using hallucinogenic drugs on the population of this small town. And essentially, as a result of that, about 500 or 600 people in that town went stark raving mad for a full day. 4 people committed suicide, and about 50 people were carted off to nearby asylums. And, of course, the agency and the Army didn't want that known in 1953 because primarily, it wasn't that the newspapers would have had a field day with it, because in 1953, the newspapers probably would have gladly covered that up, but they were extremely concerned that the Russians would learn about the experiment and have a field day in their press in Russia and Europe against the United States. It would have been extremely damaging to have it revealed that they launched an experiment in a foreign town in France.
Well, I mean, how about the country of France?
Well, that too. But when Olsen talked about that experiment, he basically, and that was about 2 weeks before he died, he essentially signed his own death warrant. The plan was to actually take him from New York, according to CIA files, to take him from New York and put him in an asylum, a mental institution that the agency had used for a number of years. And the institution was in Rockville, Maryland. It's no longer there. It was known as Chestnut Lodge. And it was a pretty well-to-do, you know, a lot of rich people went there when they suffered emotional or mental problems. But the agency favored the use of this institution for their own people, high-level employees that needed mental psychological treatment. And so it was decided to put Olsen there. I suspect that had Olsen not tried to flee in New York, that, you know, he would have made it to Chestnut Lodge and ostensibly been treated there, but probably within a week or two would have ended up hanging himself or committing suicide.
You figure they were going to do him in anyway.
Every intent to kill him,
uh-huh.
But not as grossly and as they had done in New York.
You think the CIA uses these tactics today? I guess they do. There's no reason to change.
I think they do. I'm not happy or proud or pleased or anything else to say that. I think there's lots of reasons to believe that they do. I think there was a recent case at Fort Detrick that's very analogous to the Olsen case that involved the so-called anthrax letter killer, and that was a doctor called Dr. Bruce Ivins, and the FBI now tells us, now that he's dead, that there's no doubt whatsoever that he was the man responsible for sending anthrax through all the post offices and to Senator Leahy and Senator Daschle. And I've studied that as hard and as thoroughly as I can, and I just don't see the evidence there. I just don't see, and I don't see the motive there for this man to have done that. Initially, he was actually helping them with the investigation.
I was just looking at an article today. Evidently, no one in that lab believes this guy did it. That always sounded to me like somebody was giving those senators a message.
I think it was. Uh-huh. I want to be careful what I say. I don't want to say where I think there was some sort of follow the money activities there also, and that somebody. I don't think it would take a lot of work for anybody to look at it and figure out who stood to profit the most from those anthrax letters. But I think it was both that. The profit motive, and I think it was also a way to get back at Daschle in Leahy. People had forgotten that not long before that happened, Leahy had really embarrassed the CIA by leaking some information. So I think, you know, it was definitely a hand slap, if not just an outright attempt to murder Leahy and Daschle. I really don't know. I mean, it's been proven that what they got was anthrax, and had they themselves opened those letters and breathed, you know, some of those spores, they certainly would have been dead. But that's my theory, and I just, based on the evidence that's been put out about Ivans, I don't see a person that was motivated or inclined to do that.
Hank, it seems to me that in Washington, fear rules the day. In other words, we can't really expect these elected officials to do much, can we? They're all afraid for their lives. I mean, just like we were talking earlier about Obama. And now these senators?
Well, I think it's the same thing, right? The same thing with the president. I think you hit the nail right on the head. I think, they don't want to go near it. That goes into the same psychology with the senator or congressman saying, I don't know what the CIA's budget is, and I don't care. I don't care to know. I don't want to.
Unbelievable. Extortion, murder, kidnapping, torture.
Absolutely.
And no one's going to do anything about it because they're afraid for their own safety. Seems to me mafia rules apply with government. Unbelievable.
Yeah, the work that Scott Horton did recently in Harper's Magazine with the three so-called prisoners at Guantanamo that committed suicide on the same night in the same manner with their feet and hands tied, they nonetheless were all able to hang themselves separately in three different cells, and had needle marks all over their bodies, and had just coincidentally been interrogated by the CIA hours beforehand. That's inexcusable. I mean, you know, and people wonder why people in other countries don't care for Americans. I mean, these were three young men that had families and it, like all the rest of us, whose deaths had to be explained to mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters, and who of course didn't buy the explanations because they made no sense whatsoever. Nobody can hang themselves with their hands and feet tied and rags shoved down their throats. Yet we're supposed to, the American public is supposed to just believe this stuff and not ask any questions and go on their merry way, or in a lot of cases, work the three jobs they have to work every day to make ends meet, and don't have time to think about any of this stuff.
Now, Hank, in your book and also in our conversations, I take it you think the Army is as active as ever, maybe even more than the CIA.
I do, and I think the Army always has been. Mm-hmm. I think the Army, in a lot of ways, takes direction from the CIA, and the Army intelligence units, in a lot of cases, work closely with them. But I think the Army is as independent from the president and the Congress as the CIA is, it, perhaps even more.
Yet
so.
Yet the average guy on the street thinks civilians control the Army and the military. But you suspect it's the other way around, I expect. Let's give the name of the book. People need to pick this up and read it.
The sure thing. It's my book is called The Terrible Mistake, and the subtitle is The Murder of Frank Olson and the CIA's Secret Cold War Experiments. It's available, and you can get it actually from any bookstore, any reputable bookstore, or you can order it online from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or the publisher Trine Day.
We've been discussing some pretty hot stuff here. Dangerous. Do you think you're in danger, Hank?
Well, no, but maybe after this we've talked pretty bluntly, Jerry.
I understand.
Do you feel like you're in any danger?
Yes and no.
Well, same answer. I don't. At this point, I'm 63 years old. I don't.
Well, I'm older than
people
you.
People I care a lot about, but I think what I've done is the right thing.
I think I'm like you. I'm on a mission.
Yeah, and if it results in anybody would. People would be stupid for anything to happen to me right now, and I certainly don't want to be a martyr, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's not my ambition
but,
either.
But I think it's pretty remarkable where two guys like you and I have to ask each other that question, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Yeah, it's, I don't know.
Fear, is operative these days, even here in the United States of America. I mean, it's almost like the old communist countries of old, when you and I were growing up, Hank.
I think you're absolutely right, and that's sort of what we're back to.
Yep. It's incredible. We'll be talking again.
Okay, thank you very much, Jerry. I really appreciate your talking to me.
Okay, we'll talk again.
Sure thing. Thanks a lot.
Bye.